The Guardian.
Hello, Ian Sample here. And before we get started with today's edition of Science Weekly, I'd like to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For more about building beautiful websites, go to squarespace.com. And now, on with the show.
The future of healthcare in 5-10 years to me is going to look dramatically different, and people will be sensing disease, we'll be sensing it more remotely, but we'll be capturing the data, we'll be able to therefore bring in treatments earlier, which will bring out better prognosis for the longer term.
In some of our more expensive drugs, we've started to incorporate little sensors which are capable of telling whether somebody's taken the drug, and if they haven't, to remind them to take it, and transmitting that to monitors that help tell how effective the drug is.
It employs 1.6 million people, spends more than £4,000 a second, and performed 10 million operations last year in England alone. Millions of people visit emergency units, have outpatient care, and receive help for mental health problems. This week, we're focusing on the NHS and how science and technology underpin the care doctors can give to patients. How easy is it to get breakthrough treatments into such a massive organisation? How has the NHS succeeded, and where does it fail? We look at the major innovations that are changing the NHS today and ask what science on the horizon will transform the health service in the 2020s and beyond. We'll hear from specialists in organ transplants, heart disease and eye disorders. But first, I'm joined in the studio by Professor Sir Bruce Keogh, NHS England's Medical Director and Professional Lead for NHS Doctors. Bruce is responsible for promoting clinical leadership, quality and innovation, having previously been a surgeon and physician who specialises in cardiac surgery. Bruce, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Ian.
A huge amount of research focuses on medical science and technology. When you have an organisation as big as the NHS, how hard is it to bring these things in so that they actually can start benefiting patients?
Well, Ian, firstly, can I say it can be easy and it can be difficult. We have a long track record in this country, in the United Kingdom, of our contributions to medical science. Firstly, with the discovery of the smallpox vaccine, which is said to have saved more lives than have been lost in all the battles that humankind has ever fought. We discovered antisepsis for surgery. That was Joseph Lister. Discovered that the mosquito was a carrier of malaria. We discovered the theory of evolution, the structure of DNA. We did the first blood transfusion, discovered the first antibiotic. In my specialty, discovered how to stop and start the heart electively, which is the basis of modern heart surgery. We've also done the first stem cell transplant, and we hold most of the IP for sequencing of the human genome. And I think one of the things that's always impressed me is that the first test tube baby, who was now must be about 37, that science was conducted in a district general hospital. And our contribution to medical technology, I think, has been enormous. We've invented the clinical thermometer, the ophthalmoscope, the intraocular lens, the laryngeal mask, which is used around the world for anesthesia, the CT scanner and the MRI scanner. And then when you think about our education system, that contributes as well, because we have 4 of the top 6 universities in the world, 15 of the top 100, the highest number of Nobel Prize winners per capita of population for medicine or physiology than any other country in the world. And when you think of that heritage and that background, if we can couple that with what is one of our biggest social innovations, the National Health Service, I think we have huge opportunities for introducing a whole variety of innovations into our NHS. And interestingly, if you look at the Global Innovation Index, which covers 142 economies, the UK ranks number 2 for innovation. So there are some things that we find quite easy to introduce, but there are others that we don't. And at times, in all honesty, I've been a bit disappointed to see that some of the inventions which have emerged from this country have been picked up in other healthcare systems more quickly than they have in our NHS. So we've given quite a lot of thought to how we can tackle that. And it's clear that In the old days, much of health innovation came out of health research. The sorts of innovations which are going to impact on health now are coming out of all sorts of other industries. So we've divided this country, England, into 15 different areas, which we've called academic health science networks. And in a sense, the aim is in the name. We're trying to bring together academics, providers of healthcare, industry, whether that's the pharmaceutical industry, the medtech industry, the aerospace industry, anybody that feels that they have anything to bring to healthcare, to get them into a room around the table to see how they can bring the latest developments in their areas that they think have utility in healthcare to the populations of the Academic Health Science Network, which broadly speaking are about a population of 5 million people.
The process of innovation is always ongoing, and there will be things being rolled out through the NHS at the moment which will be changing things for patients. But unless you are a patient or know someone who's in hospital, these things are probably pretty invisible to you. I'd love to hear a bit about some of the changes that are coming through in different parts of the NHS which you think are going to start making a real difference for patients.
I think there are a variety of different areas. It's not easy to necessarily predict what their impact would be. So the first area that I think is going to change medicine beyond recognition is mobile technology. So we run the rest of our lives online. We run our social lives, financial lives, retail lives, travel lives online. But we haven't yet got to a phase where we trust either ourselves or online technology enough to conduct our healthcare online. And in a sense, that's partly because we also think that healthcare should be a very personal business. But I think that's starting to change. When you look at the average mobile phone and you look at all the capabilities it has, we should easily be able to use our mobile phone to help exchange information between our healthcare providers and ourselves. So you can connect mobile phones to all sorts of devices via Bluetooth and other mechanisms now that enable us to transmit our physiological signs, any changes in our physiological status, up to people who can help us. And I think that's going to really transform things. Equally, it's going to force us to start to think about who owns information about individuals. At the moment, much of our healthcare information is stored in paper records in different organizations, and they're called the patient record. Well, it won't be long before the patient owns their own record in some kind of digital format somewhere and grants access to those people who they want to see the record. The second area, which I've partly alluded to, is what you might call portable diagnostics. You just need to walk up and down the street now and you see people wearing Fitbits and other sorts of sensors. But of course, there are many more very sophisticated sensors that are around at the moment that are capable of measuring your ECG, measuring the refractive index of your eye, measuring the amount of different types of electrolytes in your sweat, measuring the impedance through your body, measuring your gait and other physiological variables. In time, those will become increasingly sophisticated, and they will be able to tell a very sophisticated picture to remote clinicians about the status of an individual. So in my mind, if you look at heart failure, it's one of our commonest causes of admissions to hospital. I can see a time where someone who's prone to having to go in and out of hospital with heart failure is sitting at home and wearing some sort of device, and they get a phone call. An expert says to them, Mr. Jones, it looks as though you're starting to go into the early phases of heart failure again. We're sending someone around to monitor you or give you an intravenous injection of diuretic or something like that. That is going to change things dramatically. It seems to me that the next area which is going to make a difference is new types of drug delivery systems. So in some of our more expensive drugs, we've started to incorporate little sensors which are capable of telling whether somebody's taken the drug, and if they haven't, to remind them to take it, and transmitting that to monitors that help tell how effective the drug is. There are also very sophisticated drug delivery systems which are being developed in places like the Massachusetts Institute of Technology that I think will transform the way we give our drugs. The next area I think that's going to have a significant impact is around what you might call the use of digital therapies, the delivery of cognitive behavioral therapy for people with depression over either their mobile phone or their desktop, but in any event, remote from a clinician. The same sorts of things can be used for exactly what you were talking about earlier, to encourage preventative action from people so that they don't run into difficulties. One of the areas that I think the NHS can be really proud of is genome sequencing. You've already raised the issue of sequencing the whole human genome. Well, of course, a decade ago, it took the best part of a year to sequence a genome. It cost in excess of $1 billion. Now that cost is down to under $1,000, and depending on how specific you want to be, the genome can be sequenced in anywhere between an hour and 24 hours. And what this means is that the many false dawns, I think, that we've seen around human genome sequencing have now gone, and we're seeing a very real dawn for this particular type of technology. We aim to be the first country in the world to sequence 100,000 genomes. Mm. We don't underestimate the complexity of that, but we are using that particular program to look at the way that we deliver many of our genetic and related services across the country. We've identified a number of centers which we will encourage to and help to develop their ability to sequence the human genome. And we're recruiting patients into those particular studies at the moment. And the areas that we're focusing on are rare diseases, where it's quite difficult sometimes to find a diagnosis or to put a label on a diagnosis. The next major area is cancer that we'd like to focus on. So the reason that I think that's important, when I was training as a general surgeon many years ago, there are only four different types of breast cancer. Now, of course, they're in excess of 40. Adenocarcinoma of the lung, when I was a lung surgeon, we just cut out adenocarcinoma of the lung. But of course, now there are many different types of adenocarcinoma of the lung, and it's quite possible to focus the treatment that people need very specifically on that. And that's how most treatments are evolving around cancer at the moment. Healthcare will become, in time, predominantly a knowledge transfer business with a smaller and highly focused delivery arm, which may rest in the communities or in very sophisticated diagnostic and therapeutic centers, which are currently hospitals.
What will that actually mean for patients, though, this changing role for the health service, if you like?
In our country at the moment, we have more older people than we have younger people. Older people expect to have their care close to home. They expect a significant degree of the personal touch, and they expect continuity of care. A younger generation who has been brought up with Google and interactive TV expects immediacy of access to information and immediacy of response. So they have a different set of expectations. The skill that we are going to need to demonstrate in the way that we develop our healthcare services is how we provide for both groups of people what they want, knowing that the younger people will in time become the dominant population. So that with the passage of time, most people will be very digital savvy, if I can use that term. So as part of trying to address this problem, we have trained tens of thousands of people who might otherwise not have used digital technology to help them get the very best from this for their own personalized healthcare.
Sir Bruce Keogh, to find out how all this works on a day-to-day basis, I wanted to speak to three specialists from very different parts of the health service. First off, Sian Harding, Professor of Cardiac Pharmacology at the National Heart and Lung Institute at Imperial College London. She's also a theme leader at Imperial's Biomedical Research Centre, or BRC. I started by asking Sian what these biomedical research centres are for.
So this comes about from a reorganisation of the NIH money, the Department of Health money, some years ago, when the money for research was concentrated and directed in a way it hadn't been before. It was rather diffuse within the system. And it's given to centres that have critical mass, and particularly that work with universities, so you have a university partner. And the intention is that the innovative research in the university is brought through to first-in-man trials and studies. And it's really jumping that gap between what the academics are doing in the laboratory and getting that into real patient benefit. And they're very, very specific about the things that you can use this for. So it has very much to be on this agenda, not too far down the line, one way or another, this really very innovative research.
How does that system compare with those in other countries, and what sort of benefits does it bring?
I don't think there is a system like this in other countries where money is so very directly put into this effort. I think that it has much more to be done with industry, with all the problems and some benefits too that gives you. And so I think it really is a very unique thing for the NHS to be able to do this. And I think it concentrates the mind a lot. Many things that as an academic on my other research centre I'd like to do in the laboratory are really prohibited here. And it is, you have to think very much in a space that's difficult, which is how you move from cell research or animal research into human. But because of that, those very strict parameters, you can start to be creative in that area.
I know prediction's always a tough thing to do, but I wonder if throwing forwards 5 to 10 years, what you see as the likely areas for innovation that NHS patients are likely to start seeing benefits from?
I think in the device area, we're talking about the heart here, mm-hmm. The refinement of the ventricular assist devices and other things like intelligent defibrillators, pacemakers, etc., for the heart. That's one thing that's moving ahead very well. Prediction in terms of understanding if you have, for example, plaques in your arteries, which ones are going to be ones that could be unstable and so could produce a heart attack, and reducing those. I think the gene and cell therapies are definitely going to be used in some way. In the cell therapies, I think the things like the bone marrow cells, we should know fairly soon with the large trials that are going on whether that is really going to be something that produces a benefit. And then taking the not just the cells themselves, but the products of the cells and making those into a more easily administered therapy that stimulates natural regeneration. I think that could be something that comes in perhaps in the second wave. And then producing these larger grafts from the pluripotent stem cells that are actually beating heart muscle into mixed with materials to make some kind of patch. You know, I think that's a little bit further off, but it's still something that people are working very actively towards.
Sian Harding there. Next, I spoke to Professor Andrew Dick, Director of Joint Research for University College London and Moorfields Eye Hospital. I asked him to start by explaining how his research sits within the NHS.
The ability to do the research is really been manufactured by the innovation of thought through the NHS, which is establishing a platform we can all work from and aligning in partnership between educational communities such as universities and hospitals. And it's the National Institute for Health Research and their biomedical research centres and units that have helped generate that environment and culture to bring forward really an ability to take fundamental research into preclinical studies and get to faster cures for our patients.
You are the theme leader for Moorfields Biomedical Research Centre, which is one of these NIHR-funded centres. Are there a particular projects within that that you think are particularly interesting at the moment that, you know, that will have an impact on patients?
There is a lot to talk about, but I'll pick out a few. The real excitement is in two areas. One is in diagnostics, and that's innovation in creating devices that allow us to see the eye and the cells in the eye in more detail. And the future will hold a completely different picture for the way we diagnose and the way clinics run. For example, having machines that enable us to measure what we need to measure in the eye, such as pressure inside the eye, the refraction, the power of the eye, what the retina looks like, all on a single instrument, which is completely different to how we do it now. Mm. It will reduce clinic time, it will be higher resolution, it will allow us to quantify things much better. And then we're able to have machines that can even look at single photoreceptor cells. So here is unbelievable. We're able to utilize the optical qualities of the eye take physics, which is looking at adaptive optics, looking at using flexible mirrors like they do when they're looking at distant galaxies in order to get clearer pictures. So it's about teamwork on innovation of development of these machines that we partner with in order to then use what's called adaptive optics to look at single cells.
And why would you look at single cells?
Well, ophthalmologists can be extremely geeky, but there is a very good reason outside our obsessional personality. And the reasons are that the cells, in order to predict disease early, we need to know how the cells look, are they changing shape, well before we normally appreciate any pathology. And so it's a learning curve still, but you could see the future is about prediction and therefore prevention or preemption, either, which will create better health or eye care in the future.
So essentially, rather than waiting for someone to notice they have a problem and finally get round to seeing a doctor about it, you may be able to see some sort of shape changes or something going on with the cells that will tell you that this person is going towards a certain condition that you may then pick up 5 years hence.
Correct. So the future of healthcare in 5-10 years to me is going to look dramatically different, and people will be sensing disease, and we'll be sensing it more remotely, but we'll be capturing the data. We'll be able to therefore bring in treatments earlier, which will bring out better prognosis for the longer term.
We know Moorfields for a whole load of work, but some things that have been coming out fairly recently have been on these ideas that journalists always find very sexy around sort of gene therapies and cell-based therapies. Are you seeing those as being very promising for patients coming up, or what is the state of that kind of work?
I think we can't underestimate the value of the work that's been done. It's absolutely inspirational that the eyes lead on such innovative therapies. The gene therapy particularly is a great example. Here we're taking patients with rare diseases. We're utilizing the wonderful aspect of the consultants at Moorfields, who are quaternary in the sense that they get referrals of rare oddities from all around the place in order to help treat. We understand their patients' disease, their life course well, and now because of the laboratory work, everything done at in the UCL Institute of Ophthalmology sitting next door, and it translates through so rapidly and easily, is that they've adapted a gene therapy approach, which is requiring the partnership between the scientist, the patient, and the clinician in order to enable that. So what is gene therapy? I mean, it's about replacing a dysfunctional or absent gene. And it allows you to utilize viruses, but the viruses aren't dangerous. The viruses can get into the cell and therefore incorporate in the cell, so that the gene gets incorporated within the cell's gene, and then it secretes its product. It produces the protein you need, and that might prevent visual loss. So Moorfields is world leading in establishing the gene therapy program. It leads on pushing through for initially rare diseases, but that's the start. It's the future is how does gene therapy help in complex diseases, where you're targeting a gene that's very pivotal to that complex disease, such as macular degeneration or even diabetic retinopathy or diseases of the front of the eye in the cornea. So the future from the very beginning can rapidly expand, and the ability to deliver these, a one-off treatment, the genes last for a long, long time, you could see how it changed completely the treatment paradigm for our patients. And if we're picking up patients that cells are dying and it's too late for the concept of gene therapy, then there's also the push, as you know, through the London Project from Moorfields and the Institute of Ophthalmology in replacing cells. So now, you know, we're able to put cells manufactured from stem cells in order to get them into the back of the eye and replacing the cells that have been lost. So again, this completely alters an ability to even regenerate patients that may have lost vision already.
So these kinds of therapies must be pretty exciting to think about where they may be in 5 years' time, maybe 10 years' time. But are there any other areas that you think of coming in on that kind of time frame where you might see patients benefiting, whether it's a high-end sort of scientific approach like that or something different?
There's two aspects here. One is high-end scientific, but not as people see it as high-end scientific. And that's been able to what we call stratify patients at risk. So this is using technology, be it from what their gene makeup looks like to how we visualize the patient, as I talked earlier about imaging, in order to stratify the risk. So I now know that you may have a disease like glaucoma, which is a neurodegenerative disease of the optic nerve due to high pressures in the eye. And we may be able to predict and stratify your risk. So you may live for 30 years without a problem, or you're rapidly going to have a problem. And that completely revolutionized the way we treat patients, because we know which patients to treat more aggressively. And then the higher end is, of course, all the fundamental research that's looking at an ability to create much more molecules or antibodies that can inhibit cell behavior that's aberrant or poor in order to switch off diseases as early as possible. But the two need to align. You need to treat the right patient with the right treatment at the right time. And that's where I think the NHS will get to in 5 to 10 years' time.
Andrew Dick there. And finally, I spoke to Lorna Marson, an academic transplant surgeon at the Royal Infirmary, Edinburgh, with a specific interest in kidney transplants. She's also president-elect of the British Transplantation Society. I asked Lorna how the NHS has fared when it comes to innovating in transplant surgery.
I think the really exciting thing to reflect upon in transplantation is that the success in transplantation in the UK and globally mirrors, in a sense, the success of the NHS and the history of transplantation in humans as treatment for end-stage organ failure has occurred really only in the last 60 years, very much alongside the development of the National Health Service. Within the UK, there were two obstacles that had to be overcome in order to render human transplantation successful. The first obstacle was in terms of the immune system, the body's rejection of an organ, and the second is the technical aspects in surgery. And within the UK, starting really in the 1950s, the first successful transplant between identical twins was performed actually at my own hospital in the Royal Infirmary of Edinburgh in 1960 by Professor Sir Michael Woodruff, who was really one of the first pioneers globally of transplantation. And there have been two other key pioneers, I would say, from within the UK that developed understanding of the immune system that really has led to successful transplantation.
Is there anything about the NHS that really works to facilitate bringing these things into clinics? Or, you know, is it the same in the UK as it is in other countries?
It's changed. The impact of the NHS, in a sense, has changed. So I would say in the early history of transplantation, you had real pioneers such as Sir Roy Kahn, who was a trainee surgeon from Cambridge, who really took both the anti-rejection treatment forward and also the technical aspects. He performed the first liver transplant in Europe in Cambridge in 1968. So at that stage, the NHS, or working within the UK, allowed real pioneering surgery and pioneering research to take place. So Roy Kahn was then followed by Professor Sir Peter Morris, who was a pioneer in the University of Oxford, who really looked at the way we can match tissues from donors and recipients, which led to the way that the current system of organ allocation, which we're still using now. More recently, I think the real strength of the NHS, which is different from other countries, is the way that we work collaboratively. We have a special health authority, NHS Blood and Transplant, which oversees all aspects of transplantation within the UK, and information and data on all transplants that are performed is fed back to NHS Blood and Transplant, which really provides us with a unique opportunity to look at our outcomes nationally and the way improvements are happening in the delivery of patient care in the realm of transplantation. And I think that is a unique aspect that the NHS brings in transplantation.
I'm interested in what the sort of areas are that you can see from your position coming up, say, in the next sort of 5-10 years, as much as that is possible, that you think might have a real impact on patients.
Okay, so if we start with the new technologies of organ preservation, then I think that for the last 20, 30, 40 years, the techniques that we have used have been cold storage. So the organs are cooled at the donor operation, are stored on ice, if you like, and transported to another part of the UK for transplantation. And we're now beginning to understand that if we can preserve that organ at normal temperature, at body temperature, that we can use perfusion of the organs, even with drugs that might protect the organ from damage, that the outcomes when we do transplant them are improved, and it renders organs that were not suitable for transplantation when stored in the cold, it renders them then suitable for transplantation. So really optimizing the organs that we're going to use. So that's one area. I think another area, this is perhaps across many areas of medicine, of interest, is cell therapy. So can we use specific cells to protect the organs following transplantation? And one of the really major steps that were made in the 1950s by Medawar, who was the Nobel Prize winner in 1960 for his work, which demonstrated that as humans, we could acquire tolerance, which is the ability to accept an organ from somebody else without rejecting it. And it's taken us 60 years, if you like, to get to a stage where the reality of introducing cells that are protective, that allow the organ to avoid being rejected, is actually a clinical reality. And there's a clinical trial which is ongoing in which these regulatory cells are given to patients around the time of transplant with the aim of significantly protecting that organ and reducing the amount of immunosuppressive drugs, the drugs to avoid rejection, that is required. And that's really exciting. But it's taken the lifetime of the NHS to get that laboratory-based research into something which has potential real benefit for patients.
Lorna Marson there. It's clear that science and technology could transform the NHS in years to come through things like genetics, shared patient records and new technologies. To wrap up this NHS special of Science Weekly, I asked Bruce Keogh how important it is to ensure that they bring the public with them as this rate of change intensifies. How important is it that you can keep everybody on board with the kinds of changes, the kind of advances that could be brought into the NHS?
And that's absolutely vital. We live in a democracy where the people of this country own the NHS. It's theirs. It's there for them when they most need it. And sometimes innovations seem absolutely fantastic and beautiful to the experts in the area, but they can seem a little obscure and remote to the average citizen. So I think increasingly we're going to have to improve the way that we communicate with the public about what innovations mean. We've seen examples where there have been difficult debates around data sharing, for example, where there are arguments and counter-arguments. We know that there will be people who will find it difficult to engage with some of the technologies that will start to emerge. And we know that there will be people who may feel frightened about being treated at home for some conditions rather than in a hospital. Mm. One of the advantages of our society is that we can have those discussions, and indeed we should have those discussions. Healthcare around the world is gripped in a quadruple pincer of rising demand, increasing public and professional expectations, escalating costs, and constrained finances. And on top of that, we have a lot of emerging science which is likely to contribute in almost all of those areas, one of which is genomics. Mm. With genomics will come a much deeper understanding of the contribution of an individual's genetic makeup to their future health needs. And at a time that the debate around cost, structure, and administration of healthcare systems begins to become increasingly heated in different countries, people will start to look at different healthcare delivery models. And I think people will start to ask, is our NHS fit for the future? And I put it to you that we're probably one of the healthcare systems that is most fit for the future of emerging science, because we pool our resources, we pool our risk, and we share that among the whole population of the country. And at a time that it's possible to predict who might suffer from which disease, I would ask people to reflect very carefully on whether they want to be in a healthcare system based on private insurance or ability to pay.
Bruce Keogh. And that's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to Bruce, Lorna Marson, Andrew Dick and Sian Harding. From me, Ian Sample, and all the science team, thanks for listening.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you have many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design, so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.